Verdienen jouw medewerkers de beste HR-service? Wij vinden van wel. Numbers combineert payroll met slimme HR-features. Bespaar kosten en geef medewerkers eenvoudig toegang tot verlof, declaraties en loonstroken. Probeer Numbers op nmbrs.nl.
De Perestrooikast. Een blik op Oost-Europa.
Welkom bij BNR Perestrooikast, aflevering 152 van de enige podcast van Nederland die volledig oog voor het oosten heeft en geeft. In mijn geval vanaf station Haarlem.
En je staat op het punt om te gaan luisteren naar een gesprek met Ilya Ponomarenko, de oorlogscorrespondent van de Kiev Independent. En je hoort mij vanuit de studio in Amsterdam.
Ja, en Ilya is in Nederland en sprak eerder deze week in een uitverkochte Rode Hoed in Amsterdam. Daar gaf hij de jaarlijkse oktoberlezing van Ruim op Rusland. En een aantal van onze luisteraars zal daar vast ook bij zijn geweest.
Nou, we hebben er een aantal gezien en gesproken, toch?
Volgens mij moesten we snel weer door met Ilya onze zogenaamde donkere kamer in.
Oké, we hebben een beetje gezwaaid. Ik kreeg inderdaad wel nog wat appjes na afloop van waar waren jullie nou? Want er waren mensen die hadden eigenlijk bier voor ons klaargezet. Maar wij waren dan weer bier aan het halen voor Ilya. Zo zijn we dan ook wel weer. Hè? Als we mensen vragen om op een dinsdagavond 25 oktober in een donkere kamer plaats te nemen voor een gesprek met de Perestrooikast voor de nabeschouwing van zijn lezing. Wij zaten ook nog met een paar vragen, Floris.
Over hemzelf, over Zelensky, over de wapenleveranties en over wat we nou weten van het aantal slachtoffers aan Oekraïnse zijde.
Right now it's between 50 and 60 killed and all wounded soldiers each and every day. This is what we know. These figures look realistic.
Het werd een gesprek van een klein half uur in dat donkere zaaltje in de Rode Hoed. Met op de achtergrond de mensen die allemaal op Ilya waren afgekomen. En je weet het, in de Perestrooikast kan alles ten oosten van de rivier de Elbe en ten westen van Haarlem Centraal de komende weken, maanden, jaren in deze podcast besproken worden. Ha, daar is de omroepster.
De omroepster klinkt weer door voor de trein richting Heemstede-Adenhout. Ik wil nog even wat zeggen. Wat heel leuk is dat we heel sociaal en democratisch zijn. En abonneer op ons, zodat je geen aflevering hoeft te missen. BNR Perestrooikast. Zoek ons op in je favoriete podcast-app.
Hallo Heemstede, dat is nog verder van de Elbe vandaan.
We zakken langs van het weg naar warmere orde.
Nou, binnenkort een IJsland-podcast. Ik ben Geert-Jan Haan.
En ik ben Floris Akkerman.
En dit is BNR Perestrooikast. Hey, je hebt bezoek. Wat leuk. Ben je nou niet meer alleen in die wachtkamer?
Nu ben ik weer alleen, ja.
Oké.
Ze lopen weg.
Ah. Dag. Ilya Ponomarenko is de bekendste Oekraïense oorlogscorrespondent in het buitenland, mede dankzij het platform Twitter. Met veel tweets in het Engels heeft hij veel volgers aan zich gebonden van over de hele wereld. Ruim 1,2 miljoen volgens mij. Laten we niet vergeten dat Ilya ook nog maar 30 jaar is. De oorlog is hem natuurlijk ook overkomen. Aan het begin van die grootschalige Russische invasie had hij natuurlijk geen idee van de mate van verslag die hij zou gaan doen van deze oorlog. En dat zei hij ook tijdens de oktoberlezing.
Zeker. Je kunt ons interview met Ilya uiteraard los beluisteren. Maar wil je meer weten over zijn verhaal, luister dan ook de lezing terug. En daarna naar ons als een nabeschouwing. De link van de lezing van Ruim op Rusland zetten we in de show notes. Wat vond je eigenlijk van zijn lezing, Geert-Jan? Je zat achter een paal verscholen, dus kon je alles wel goed zien?
Ik kon alles goed horen. Dat is misschien het belangrijkste.
Zeker.
Ik vond het een interessante lezing. Het was geen gelikt verhaal, vond ik ook wel mooi. Het begin was ook ijzersterk, hoe hij de slag om Kiev heeft ervaren. Daar beginnen we zo ook ons gesprek met hem mee. Ik had wel het idee dat hij een beschaafde lezing gaf. Hij is een onafhankelijke journalist, maar hij kan ook niet alles prijsgeven van wat hij meemaakt. Maar misschien iets meer tipjes van de sluier oplichten. Zat ook niet heel veel nieuws in zijn analyse. Klinkt het heel flauw om te zeggen dat ik het meeste wel wist?
Nee, dat is zeker herkenbaar. Ik denk dat ook als je dat op de voet volgt, niet snel verrast zijn door zijn lezing. Behalve dat persoonlijke gedeelte, hoe hij de slag om Kiev beleefde en zijn moeder samen moest evacueren, samen met zijn vriendin, en gezeten in de auto van een vriend en de beslissing moest maken om weer terug te keren naar Kiev, terwijl Kiev volop werd aangevallen door de Russen.
Ja, natuurlijk ook. Voordat die lezing begon, een reis van 30 uur erop zitten. Dus dat hij wat vermoeid overkwam, dat accepteren we natuurlijk gewoon. Wat heel grappig was tijdens ons gesprek, daar ga je zo naar luisteren, zat hij ook op zijn horloge te kijken. Want het was al laat op de avond en in Oekraïne heb je natuurlijk een avondklok. Dus hij was helemaal ook eigenlijk uit zijn ritme. Zo van, het is donker en er is bijna niemand meer. Moet ik nu niet eigenlijk binnen blijven? Maar ik moet zo naar buiten, want ik moet zo naar mijn hotel. Dat was wel Ja, hij zat in een hele andere wereld nog.
Volgens mij wilde hij gewoon vanaf van ons af en zo snel mogelijk de kroeg in.
Floris, wij zitten hier in een zaal in de Rode Hoed met Ilja Ponomarenko. Uh-huh. Wat voor zaal is dit?
Een feestzaal zou ik zeggen, waar je gewoon een mooi privéfeest kan houden.
Hoe vond je de lezing?
Ik vond het mooi en goed. Vooral het persoonlijke verhaal over zijn moeder. Hoe hij die wegbracht in alle stress. En besloot om terug te keren, omdat het toch journalistiek zijn roeping was. Ja. Tijdens de Eerste Oorlogdagen.
So Ilja, we started reviewing your lecture. It was very personal. I don't know if all your lectures are that personal and from the heart.
Of the months of this big war, I noticed and I made it clear to myself that personal account works well to Western people, to foreign audience in general, because everybody can get any information about facts from Wikipedia. So I will not be telling you new things when it comes to, you know, pure, you know, list of facts. What matters is the emotions, what matters is the personal stories, and what matters is the trust that goes beyond those stories. So it's easier and it's more effective to tell the story to an audience that trusts you as a person. So that's why it's personal. That's why I have a lot of things to tell to people. And that's why people are attentive towards it, because it's just not some, you know, generic set of facts and generic statements. This is something that they have never heard before.
By the way, are you aware of the fact that you're some kind of Twitter geroy to people, and that's how they know you and why they came to this lecture?
I don't know. I'm not really a big fan of talking about, you know, sort of significance on Twitter, because people bombard me on interviews and, you know, in general. It's become a running joke in the Kyiv Independent newsroom. Everybody wants to sting me about this and have a silly joke about this, about how many followers does this guy have? Like, he's our Twitter god. It's like, people, simply stop it. But yeah, I find it very, very, very surprising for me and very pleasant that so many people were ready to listen to, you know, a very, very simple guy from Ukraine just telling what he feels like, just telling what's happening in front of his eyes. So I really appreciate it, and I tried to keep up with expectations and to keep up with this trust, not to let down my the people that have trust in me. So it's an additional work for me to do.
I understand, but when I follow you on Twitter, I think about the picture you posted from this enormous crater in Mariupol, I think, one of the first weeks, and that's, it has a purpose, right, to use social media.
Of course, yeah, of course. I wasn't in Mariupol during the invasion, so many things that I post come from Ukrainian social media. So the things that I post are the things that I consider worthwhile for the Western audience to see and to understand. So if it appears on my feed, mm-hmm. So it means that I decided that you should know this, you should see this. Unfortunately, I can't cover all of this war, because even though I work basically 24/7, so it's not always that I have a chance and I have an ability to cover all those things. So the main purpose is to simply keep the world informed about what's happening. As simple as that, because we in Ukraine, we depend a lot on public opinion in Western nations. And we end up simply saying the truth, because we have nothing to lie about. As simple as that. Our, you know, information of war is to be telling the truth of this mess, of this chaos, of this buzz of disinformation about this. So hopefully it works.
During the lecture, you told about at the beginning of the war, the first days, you evacuated your mother from Kyiv to the west of Ukraine, together with your girlfriend, if I'm not mistaken. Are they still in the western part, or did they come back to Kyiv?
My girlfriend came back to Kyiv shortly following the end of the Battle of Kyiv, when the immediate threat was gone. My mother spent some time in Western Ukraine with the family of my girlfriend, to be precise. Then she moved to Dnipro because she wanted to have some more activity in her life. She wanted to get a job, get back to the job, actually, Dnipro. And right now, my mother has settled down in the city of Bucha, just basically very close to me because I'm just about to move to Bucha as well. So as part of the process in which many people get back to life when the Battle of Kyiv was over, many people also get back to the cities in Bucha, in Irpinian, Kyiv, and my loved ones were not different.
Mm-hmm. All the time we're also talking about casualties, mm-hmm. how many people got killed. Do you know?
In general, we tend to know the general situation. When it comes to military deaths, we know it. It's about a bit more than 10,000 dead soldiers killed since the beginning of the invasion. We have this information from the authorities. It was publicly revealed. when it comes to civilian deaths, it's a very complicated question because according to UN estimates, it's close to 6,000. But in the all reports, the UN says that this death toll is far from being complete because we have no idea how many people get killed in Mariupol. And we will probably we'll never know this even if/when we get back to Mariupol, because one of the recent things that I heard from Mariupol, from people that are there and they have connection with us, is that Russians started demolishing the houses, the ruined and damaged houses in Mariupol. They did not recover bodies underneath those ruins. And still a large amount of those ruins and rubbles of residential houses were never cleared. So all those rubbles have a lot of dead bodies in there of those who used to live in those houses. So we will probably never know how many of those people killed because they basically just demolished and just went out in nowhere. And
sorry to interrupt you. Are there estimations to make?
Again, a very complicated question because local authorities in Mariupol, they report various estimates starting from nearly 20,000 dead in Mariupol to 88,000 dead in Mariupol. We do not know. And we have little chance to actually know how many of those people were, for instance, gone missing or killed, so we can identify the body. Because Mariupol has become a city surrounded by a cemetery, because lots of improvised graves, collective graves, mass graves. So we know that they exist. We have all the pictures, and they're massive. But also, it's a big question if we have a person missing. The question is, was this person just buried under the rubble of those houses demolished by Russians, or was it expelled into Russia and settled down somewhere in Russia? It's a mess. It's an absolute mess. It's going to be a very big question for many years in coming. Volovakha, my hometown, which is just north of Mariupol, also a big question. Before the big invasion, it had 30,000 residents, close to 30,000, but it basically ceased to exist as a human settlement. It just can't sustain life. Most of people got evacuated, but also people, my relatives, the people that I know that were hiding in basements for days. So without water, without food. Many people tried to escape, just to get out of basements and try to run their way to somewhere. And many people who managed to do this, many did not make it. And they said that the streets were just covered with dead bodies. Well, those who never made it, obviously. So how many people got killed in there, we do not know, because the whole city was just razed to the ground. I'm having the feeling for quite a long time. It is not something that people should refer to. It's just my feeling, my estimate, that we might face the end of this war with death toll on the Ukrainian side is close to 100,000 people, military and civilian deaths. That's my expectation, my estimate.
But those 10,000, that's the official figure, right?
Do we trust?
Yes.
We tend to be trustful about these figures because, you know, in this age, there are very little things that can be hidden from public eye. In our age, everybody's got a smartphone in the pocket. In the internet, everyone is exposed, and everyone is exposed doing something. And besides, over the years of war in Ukraine, we have a very steady mechanism of monitoring, you know, military deaths. So many media outlets, many volunteer communities, they collect information, biographies, pictures of killed soldiers, and they publish them online, so they have lists of soldiers, so of verified deaths. Because when a soldier is killed, it's likely that you can hide his death away, because there will be funerals, there will be people, there will be relatives, everybody is exposed to public eye, so it's very hard to conceal things from the public eye in this day and age. So the Ukrainian military, they try to be pretty open and honest on the general level. So we know general situation. But when it comes to tactical situation, for instance, we have basically no information about this. But at this day and age, we know how many people, how many soldiers we have lost in general, the whole distal. And we tend to have a general understanding how many casualties we sustain each and every day. Right now, it's between 50 and 60 killed and all wounded soldiers each and every day. This is what we know. These figures look realistic. Mm-hmm.
You said during the lecture you were very critical on Zelensky. You still are? Or is this a period that you don't have to be critical on your president, even as a journalist?
I definitely changed my opinion about some aspects of him as a wartime leader. He's definitely doing a good job at presenting Ukraine. We must admit this. He has done a very good job staying. He has done a very good job, although in the very final moments, of forming a team. Because right now we have the best team of top general, of defense minister, of prime minister, of in general one of the best governments that we could get throughout the all years of independence, especially when it comes to top military commands, the best one in the whole period of independence, and defense ministry. So he was really good at this. But still we have many things for which we criticize Zelensky, which is very questionable preparation for the war. His very questionable position regarding the public awareness about the preparation of this war. So in general, we acknowledge that he did a great job. He changed a lot. Why I told you that I was kind of critical about Zelensky and his posture as a president. You know, once upon a time, there was this thing, was Steinmeier formula. Not many people do recall this thing, but there was the Steinmeier formula, like a roadmap to implementation of Minsk agreements. And it was apparently approved by the council of all sides interested, including Russia. So there was a bit of an uproar about this because it was seen like a capitulation behind this to Russia. And Zelensky summoned top journalists, Ukrainian and foreign journalists at the presidential office in Kiev. So he took questions from us. And at some point, there was someone from the U.S. I'm not sure who that was, but someone major from the U.S. And that was in the middle of the Trump scandal with Trump withdrawing U.S. Military assistance for the sake of fighting information about Biden. And obviously the U.S. media outlets start asking questions about, you know, Trump involvement in this regard, whether he was trying to extort something from Ukraine, some information on Biden. So Zelensky gave his answer, but at the same time he declined to, you know, to go further about this. And he said it was like 5 p.m. on the clocks, and he said, "Hey guys, it's 5 p.m. I gotta go, so I have family." And, you know, the U.S. reporters, they started putting, but Mr. President, could you just explain what it is? It's a question of national security for this. Can you please elaborate? Give us a couple of minutes. He was like, trying to say in the broken English, "Do you have any children?" It's like five, we were looking at him, "Dude, you are president of a country. I don't care if you have children or not. If you're five p.m. and it was like, what are you even talking about?" So he was always enjoying himself as a president in the status of president, but he was never a good fan of working as a president. But, you know, this work tended to be something that changed many people or revealed their true self. And this concerns many people, and including Zelensky. So he also managed to change and did his best in this regard. But this, "Do you have any children?" Yeah, it haunted me for quite a long time.
But could he have done more to prepare Ukraine better before the war started?
Again, a very, very debatable question. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that were of huge debate, like, a couple of months ago in Ukraine, because many details went up, showing that many questions went up, showing that many things that probably could have been done were not done. Especially when there was this publication from the U.S. media, like Washington Post, saying that the U.S. had a very profound and very detailed information about the invasion, but they were showing Ukraine not the whole picture. So there have been questions on their side. The biggest question was that should Ukrainian public be warned about the upcoming invasion in this regard? What would naturally expect to say yes, because people need to know if Russia is just about to invade and launch the biggest war since World War II about this. But then again, What if Zelensky warned the general public that Russia is to invade on February 24th, and nothing happens? And nothing happens because they are to decide when. Mm-hmm. Then some time comes, then you know, we delay the invasion day, nothing happens again, and when the whole nation is just says, "Guys, to hell with you. Russians do this," when the nation is not prepared for this. So there have been always this need to sustain the economy, sustain a normal life, which is very crucial for Ukrainian economy, and the need to be doing something about this. Now, following the events that we have seen, I think most of the things that should have been done have been done. When it comes to the military, for instance, the military decided to relocate military units, aircraft, so they could be saved from Russian missiles, initial Russian wave of strikes. The whole chain of command was reorganized and disinvolved and decentralized. We have already mentioned this. So I think, given the very fact that Ukraine managed to sustain the first attack, to defeat the Blitzkrieg, mm-hmm. And basically strategically win the war within 5 days, because the only hope for Russia to succeed was the quick victory. This fact also said that this preparation might not be perfect because the world is complicated, but it was happening. It was happening, otherwise we would not be where we are today.
From your perspective, of course, you're asking the West for weapons, whatever we have, maybe. But on the other hand, we're also sometimes giving you whatever we have. We look on the shelves and it's like, okay, we have maybe some helmets left and some uniforms. Could there be a more specific delivery to Ukraine? Because sometimes it feels like, oh, we have some leftovers, we give it to Ukraine. Do you get what you need to win this war?
Yes, we do. Because we are having a situation in which nothing could be in vain. You know, we need everything, helmets included, vests included. The complexity behind this is that we have things that we need right now, and we need them as much as possible in quantities as large as possible. And some things are more or less fine, such as helmets, such as vests. We still need them, but they are not top priority. When it comes to top priority right now, it's about air defense. It's about armor, any armor that you can get. Not necessarily tanks, but also light armor, cars, trucks. Not many people talk about, you know, trucks. Trucks are actually the veins of military infrastructure, of logistics. Trucks are absolutely essential, even though not many people talk about this. Give the military trucks and you'll be happy forever.
Fuel is not a question anymore. That's okay for now.
Fuel, not of super pressing need. Not of super pressing need. It's more about mechanisms. Artillery pieces. We got some pieces from Netherlands, and Netherlands were included in this, but still, we have having a situation in which we mobilized the armed forces to the quantity of 700,000, which is like four times the size of the pre-war, pre-big invasion. So, in this regard, you have to find as much weaponry as you can get to actually, you know, equip all those new units. So we basically accept everything, but some things are of absolute necessity, which is, for instance, radio communications, absolutely essential. Munitions, especially when it comes to artillery munitions. There are lots of things that can be provided to Ukraine, and we absolutely thankful for this. But the problem is not only the type of things that we get, also all things not necessarily militarily, but also things like warm clothes, tents, medical kits, absolutely everything is needed. But also quality, but also quantity matters. Yeah, it's good that Ukraine gets like three pieces of Panzerhaubitze, but we still have the need of having like at least 500 new artillery pieces. So it's also about quality, quantity. And in this regard, sometimes we face a situation, for instance, if the US provides us with the most modern and coolest artillery pieces like M777, the glorious ones. And at the same time, the US has a huge amount of older weapons, M198. These are like a previous generation howitzers. They are not as modern, they are not as perfect, but still they are good, and the US military does not use them. So they are like a previous generation, but still they are good and we want them. But the question is, why not provide Ukraine with the older guns? Let there be like 500 guns which are older, not as perfect, but these are 500 guns. I got this question for the US Secretary of Defense Austin. He said that he thought that, you know, the precision and the distance that the newer weapons provide is what exactly Ukraine needs. But he does not share the same mood that quantity also matters.
Mm. But shouldn't Ukraine receive stuff, weapons, etc. beforehand? Now it's all the time that's...
You are hitting the very, very heart of the Ukrainian public debate on Facebook. Because, every single Ukrainian has had a post on Facebook saying that why providing weapons to us right now, they should have provided us long beforehand, so this could never happen. Yes, ideally, yes. But we try to be realistic about this.
When the orders are given, like they are preparing an offensive, for example, they give an order that don't put stuff, video, etc. on social media. How is it possible that an army with thousands of soldiers can hold this discipline and not? And is in this age of social media, how is it possible today?
I think it's a very good question.
It's very good. It's very simple. It's not happening. It's not happening because we know tons of videos, tons of photos, tons of personal accounts from soldiers. This is how we basically painted the picture, the general picture of what's happening. We do kind of have a ban on posting things from battlefields. We kind of have a very strict ban that people actually serve on posting pictures immediately after missile strikes, so that Russians couldn't get information about these strikes. There's a ban on posting pictures showing what's the word for this, the serial numbers of aircraft was downed by, so they couldn't get information about the trajectory and stuff. But in reality, Ukrainians being Ukrainians, they ignore things that are not super essential. Yes, you can get lots of videos from battlefields, and Ukrainian military, the Ukrainian defense ministry, who issued these orders, they gladly repost those things on their official accounts as part of the, you know, promotion, you know, of the Ukrainian cause. The very videos they ban in theory on paper, but when it's looking good, when it's nice, when it's encouraging, so why not posting them on our website, on our Twitter feed? So yeah, in general, it's always an interesting question of wartime censorship in Ukraine. It does not exist. It's as simple as that, to our great surprise. Ukrainian political life is super emotional in wartime as well. It's super super trended towards, you know, arguing against everything on from everyone. And a general Ukrainian and also journalist is absolutely free to criticize. You can write a post on Facebook saying that you absolutely do not agree about certain things, and you'll get no issues about this. And many people will support about you in this. So yeah, it's Ukraine remains a very open society and very active society in which everyone has a say. Because sometimes it's annoying because everybody's got an opinion on everything. Everybody's got an opinion on how this operation should have been conducted. So yeah, surprisingly, we do not have what we expect to be a wartime censorship. So we talk about everything and we ask no one. And if someone's not happy about in the highest corners, if someone's not happy, it's not our problem.
En dat was de nabeschouwing van de oktoberlezing met Ilya Ponomarenko. Nogmaals, heb je de lezing nog niet beluisterd? Doe dat voor een volledig indruk van zijn kijk op de oorlog.
En ook veel plezier met onze andere podcasts. Er zijn er veel die we deze dagen publiceren. Bijvoorbeeld onze Caucasische podcast die eraan komt met niemand minder dan Isa Yusibov. Dat is een Twitter Spaces editie die we ook hebben verpodcast. Dus daar kun je binnenkort van genieten ook.
Ja, ik ben benieuwd naar Isa's zijn danskunsten, ja. Caucasisch.
Betekent dus ook de volgende aflevering een mop erbij.
Gegarandeerd. Paka.
Ajeto.
Verdienen jouw medewerkers de beste HR-service? Wij vinden van wel. Numbers combineert payroll met slimme HR-features. Bespaar kosten en geef medewerkers eenvoudig toegang tot verlof, declaraties en loonstroken. Probeer Numbers op nmbrs.nl.